By noon, a crowd of about 50, huddled under newspapers and umbrellas, had already gathered at the Spirit Center for Arigoa TMS afternoon session. Even though they would have to wait until 3 for Arigoa TMS return, they wanted to be sure they got a place in line. Some were pinning their entire hopes on him, and had come a long distance. Two were foreign, one from Spain, another from Chile. They were both girls. At just about noon, Arigo decided that the storm had let up enough for them to set out on the trip. Arigoa TMS mood had lifted since the distribution of the gifts on the previous day. 215, he gave Arlette a cheerful kiss, roughed up Tarcisia a TMS thick black hair, and went out to the Opala with Ribeiro. Waiting for the train at the railroad station was a well-known Brazilian doctor, who was leaving for Rio after a trip to observe and query Arigo in a search for an explanation of the man and his work. He saw the blue Opala as it swung around the curve from Arigoa TMS house. Arigo, at the wheel, saw the doctor, and pulled the car over to the side of the station to talk with him a moment. After a jocular greeting, Arigo said, "Hey, have you got everything explained now? ATM." The doctor smiled. "Hey, if I ever explain you, ATMLL be a genius. I enjoyed your party yesterday, TM. He was referring to the gathering in which Arigo had handed out the many boxes of clothing. No child had gone away without a gift. ATMM very happy about it. Very happy ATM," Arigo said. "I love the faces of the children. It went well ATM. I thought so, to ATM," the doctor said. ATMLL be back to see you soon ATM. I hope we ATMLL see you ATM," Arigo said. He put the car in gear, waved again, and spun off. The rain was picking up again, and the wipers were straining against it. A short distance out of town, Arigo stopped at a gas station, filled up with gas, and tried to adjust the wipers a little better. Coming out of Lafayette, the pickup truck of the National Highway Department was having some difficulty negotiating the turns in the heavy rain. The roads in Brazil are marked off with small kilometer signs. Near K.370 on route BR-135, Timoteo eased up on his speed a little to squint at the road, with its unrelenting curves. By the time he reached K.373, the rain had again eased off, and he pushed the accelerator down to highway speed. Highway marker K.374 was just about 3 kilometers from the gas station that Arigo had stopped in. There is a particularly treacherous blind curve at the marker. Anxious to get the annoying red tape over within Lafayette, Arigo left the station and started down the road. He passed his rose garden, glancing at it fondly, although it was 216, hardly visible through the rain and mist. The pickup truck was nearing marker K.374, soon to appear around the curve. It had just come into sight when Timoteo saw a blue car start to move across the road toward him. It was not skidding, just coming directly across the road. Beside the road was a precipice 400 feet deep. There was no possible way he could drive off the road to avoid the blue car coming at him. The road was too slick to stop suddenly. He applied the brakes anyway, and at that moment the two cars smashed. There was a terrifying metallic thud that was heard more than a kilometer away. There was silence in both cars. Back at Arigoa TMS house, Bedja had been invited to have some cake and a cup of coffee before returning to his work at the hotel. Arlette had gone off with her umbrella to shop. Tarcisio had taken his VW to check the rose bushes for Arigo. Bedja was finishing the last mouthful of cake when a neighbor opened the door and called, "Hey, go to the highway quickly. Something terrible has happened to Arigo." ATM, Bedja dropped his fork and rushed out of the house. He ran like a wild man to a taxi by the railroad station. He told the driver to drive quickly out to the BR-135. Within minutes, they saw the blue Opala up ahead, in the center of the slick highway. The smashed pickup truck of the highway department was fused to the Opala. At the wreckage, all was silent, there was not even a groan. The door on Arrigoa TMS side was open. His legs still in the car, his body half out of it. His legs were mangled. A steel rod of some kind had plunged through his massive chest like a spear. Bedja froze for a moment, then ran to Arrigo and ripped the steel rod out of the body. It was covered with blood. There was a huge gap in the head and in the chest. For some reason, he noticed Arrigo's TMS watch. It was stopped at exactly 12:15. Then a scream suddenly came from the pickup truck. It was the treasurer of the highway department. Bedju, knowing that Arrigo was dead, ran to help him. He felt he was going mad. There was no sounds from Timoteo. 217 seconds later, Tarcisio arrived. He looked at his father, and dropped beside the body, heaving with enormous sobs. Then the police arrived. And an ambulance. There was confusion and shouting. Felicido, the highway department treasurer, died at the hospital. Arrigo and Ribeiro were pronounced dead on arrival. Only the unconscious Timoteo survived. Bedju walked all the way back to the hotel in a daze. I will carry this terrible weight all my life, Fiat, he told a friend. Congonhas do Campo came to a stop. Other town has been orphanada, someone said. Another said, with Arrigo dead, Congonhas has been assassinated, The mayor declared 2 days of mourning, with the flag at half-mast. The shops and the bars were closed until after the burial. Dr. Mauro Godoy was not a man to cry, but he did. He went to the scene with the police and the men from the highway department, and studied the wreckage. There were no signs of skidding, although the wetness might have obliterated them. Arrigo's TMS car had crossed to the wrong side of the road. It appeared as if it had simply gone out of control. Later, Dr. Godoy assisted at the autopsy. Signs that he saw in the brain and cardiac region convinced him that Arrigo had died from a coronary moments before he crashed. With a dead man at the wheel, the car had gone out of control. The rest was inevitable. They came from all over. A parade of special planes flew into Lafayette. The press was everywhere. Special buses arrived, this time with mourners instead of patients. Arrigo's TMS shattered body lay in its coffin in his home. Arlit stood by it, tearless and numb, just staring at it. Roberto Carlos, his long hair flowing, arrived with his wife. He was dressed in blue jeans and black boots, with a medallion of Christ pinned to his belt. With the help of police, he made his way through the dense crowd to the coffin. He embraced Arlit and kissed her hand. My child can see because of Arrigo's TMS, he said. Then he turned to the casket and said, I am here, Arrigo's TMS. There was no mass, no music, no service. No one counted the people who filed by the casket, and flowed 218, silently along the packed streets, like a giant moving carpet behind the bier. Some said 15,000, some said 20. The air was full of silence, one observer said. The pallbearers drew the casket on a small cart to Arrigo's TMS beloved Union Hall. Then they tugged it by hand up the steep cobblestone hill to the cemetery. High on the hill, with the mountains rimming the horizon, the body was interred. Far across on another hill, the 12 baroque statues of Elia Jadino stood like guardians, some with hands outstretched, pointing across the valley to the cemetery. A lone Franciscan priest murmured a prayer that was barely audible. The crowd, sprawled across the green hillside, moved like a great herd of sheep slowly back to the village. Whatever was said in words, the thought was the same, Arrigo is no more TMS. Another thought, a phrase from Arrigo, was unspoken but implicit, for his body could not be taken to the church, Christ is the same. The rest dos natimus matra TMS. 219, Epilogue. I have found that I cannot resist a story that is slightly far out, as long as there is a rich fund of solid, down-to-earth, material documentation to go with it. Without the latter, the story is utterly useless. With it, it is intriguing. I had a relaxed lunch at the Players in New York several years ago with Arthur Twitchell, an astute and erudite gentleman who had been co-producer of one of my plays that came into Broadway at the Helen Hayes Theatre, faltered, and died unmourned. Twitchell was a member of the board of the American Society for Psychical Research, founded by William James in the late 19th century. He was also an avid student of what might be called the rational occult. He told me briefly about the story of Arago. If I had not known Twitchell to be a man of discernment, I would have attributed it to fantasy and forgotten about it. I did tell him that a story of this sort would be utterly unbelievable, and that even if it were true, it would be an almost impossible job for a writer to convey. Twitchell said, "You ought at least to look at the films ATM. There are films taken of these operations?" "ATM?" I asked. "They were taken by the team of American doctors who went down to Brazil to study Arago ATM," he said. "All you need is a strong stomach ATM. My curiosity was aroused. I was looking for a good story. Twitchell put me in touch with Dr. Henry Puharich, who was kind enough to show me the films at his home in Westchester County. Twitchell was right about the strong stomach. When you see a paring knife go up under the eyelid, and pry the eyeball half out of its socket, and scrape the socket mercilessly, it ATMs a bit of a shock. I looked at the films twice, complete with hydroxyles, tumors, cataracts, sebaceous cysts, retinoblastomas, and all the rest. At times I had to look away. 220, but their dramatic power was overwhelming. I thought about the story for a long time. It was obvious that, in spite of the considerable amount of medical records available, I would have to go to Brazil and check the story in detail. Nothing could be second-hand in a story like this. It was a chronicle that would have to be verified in every aspect. But there was another problem. If the story did check out, and the book drew wide readership, what would it do to Arago and his work? Would people who were desperately ill in the United States spend large sums of money to go to Brazil only to find Arago so flooded and exhausted with additional patients that he could not handle them all? When I decided to go ahead with the story after Arago ATM's death, I told Puharich that I would be unable to depend on his word or the records of the medical group alone. He quickly agreed with me. "You will want to check everybody in Brazil and here you can get your hands on ATM," he said. His enemies, as well as his friends. You must never take the word of a single source on any aspect of the story ATM. I was still skeptical. But there would be very clear and important checkpoints for challenging the story when I got to Brazil. Most important would be the judges, the attorneys, and the court records of Arago ATM's long drawn-out trial proceedings. Here the harshest spotlight possible had been turned on Arago. There would be both character witnesses and expert testimony to draw on, all of it under oath. Another important checkpoint would be former President Juscelino Kubitschek. Here was a tough realist, the man who had built Brasilia, the most outstanding capital in the world. The problem was, would I be able to find him, and to question him in depth? Others to check would be the Brazilian doctors, as many as I could get hold of, government officials, the clergy, the local townspeople, the police officials, foreign service officers, who could supply an outsider ATM's view on this incredible legend, former patients, Arago ATM's family, and any other leads that would be bound to spring up. I was satisfied from my preliminary probing that the 221 story at least could either be confirmed or challenged to the point where it would fall apart. I was intrigued enough to take the risk, and so were the publishers. In the case of the Arago research, there were often slightly conflicting reports. I had to weigh these carefully, and choose those from the source that appeared the most substantial. Whatever choice I made, it would not be made lightly. 2. I had one other problem, but it turned out to be an asset rather than a drawback. I had already contracted to write a book on the new, deadly Lassa virus that had suddenly sprung up from nowhere, deep in the Cameroon highlands of northern Nigeria. In contrast to Arago, this was a hard, tough, scientific, medical mystery story, with the most pragmatic and materialistic sort of documentation, including everything from electron microscopy to the entire staff of virologists at Yale and the government at TMS Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. Some interesting things happened in Nigeria which accidentally had a great deal of bearing on my attitude towards the Arago research later. The tracking down of the Lassa virus story took me on a 3,000-mile trip through Nigeria in a Land Rover, on what literally could be called a small game safari, the virus being just about the smallest possible to pursue. The trip took me to lonely medical missionary stations from near Lake Chad A in the very center of the widest bulge of equatorial Africa A to the Joes Plateau. It took me to government catering rest houses, vestiges of the British colonial days, mining camps, tribal villages, small African cities, provincial diplomatic posts, the medical research sections of Nigerian universities, and other places where tourists are not likely to venture. It was in the off hours in places like this where I learned that the local medicine man of the villages was held in the greatest respect by foreign diplomats, missionary doctors, 222, medical researchers, university professors, mining engineers, whatever the station of the European or American expatriate. Far from being an absurd cartoon character, the local witch doctor, medicine man, man, or doo-doo man, whatever the terminology that was used, was feared and respected in the community, and was not to be trifled with. But not from fear alone. Some of the witch doctors at TM, medical concoctions were being seriously studied by the University of Ibadan Medical School, one of Africa TM's finest. One concoction reduced malignant tumors to zero in laboratory mice. Further success in reducing psychosis to an absolute minimum was being studied and lauded by the World Health Organization of the United Nations, in line with Luis Rodriguez's TMS theories. The attitude of reasonable and intelligent men in Nigeria created an atmosphere that opened my mind somewhat for the trip to Brazil. When I arrived in Rio, I was filled with the cold, cruel realities of the Lassa virus, and the burned and dry famine-stricken savannas of the sub-Sahara. The contrast was a welcome change. The shift to the Portuguese language was not TMT welcome, however. It made the research very difficult. Eventually I was able to find interpreters who went out of their way to be helpful. I had a long list of leads for information. With the language barrier, it was a painstaking job to follow them up. My contacts with American and other journalists made it abundantly clear that whatever Arago was, he wasn't TMT a fake. Their personal knowledge was verified in the files of the newspaper morgues and the court records over a 20-year period. This was a good foundation to work from, because I had planned to go directly back to the States if Arago or TMS life and work appeared even slightly ambiguous. Kubitschek was most gracious when I called on him. He spoke in a deep, powerful, but labored English. He told me he was delighted that someone from the States was doing a book on Arago, because he was utterly convinced that there had never been anyone in the history of medicine like him. He freely offered any information I wanted about his personal experiences with Arago, and said that as a doctor and 223 surgeon himself, he was dumbfounded by what Arago could do. It was a stimulating and fruitful interview. When I asked him about Brasilia, his eyes lit up and he laughed. Even my enemies admit that it has opened up Brazil today. I am proud of it, RTM. He chuckled over the story of how he had been trapped into building the city by the spectator in the crowd of congongas. I had forgotten completely about that article in the constitution that required the capital to be built. I could not go back on my word. So I built it, RTM. 3. From that point on, confirmation of the Arago phenomenon came thick and fast. Jorge Rinia TMS color films were startling, vivid, and unchallengeable. Dr. Ari Lex and the author Hernani Andrade welcomed me to their homes and provided me with full information and documents on their studies of Arago over 2 decades. I had lunch at the S.A. Tilda Pando Paolo Hilton with Dr. Antonio Ferrario Filho, an energetic, salt and pepper-haired radiologist, who not only confirmed Arago TMS prowess in great detail, but introduced me to the background of the Cardesist intellectuals in Brazil. It seemed there was no one who did not TMT have a friend or relative who had been successfully treated by Arrigo. These included George and Susan Brown from the American Embassy, Joe and Kathleen Caltagirone, an American investment banker, and his wife, Elaine Handler, from Time magazine, Fred Perkins, the McGraw-Hill representative in Brazil, and his wife, Dr. Raimund Overas, of the Centro de Rehabilitação with branches in several Brazilian cities, and his son, Dr. José Tilda Copyright Carlos Varas, Dr. Clark Quilla, a former professor at Northwestern University, and Guy Playfair, a British journalist. They and dozens of others went out of their way to provide leads and dig up information that would have been impossible to find otherwise. Particularly helpful was Mrs. Irene Granchi, of Rio, who 224, supplied me with material from the exhaustive files on Arrigo that she had kept since the beginning of his career. She introduced me to publishers and editors who, in turn, had their own stories about the healer. What I had thought would be a long, slow job of digging up scattered scraps of information turned out to be a problem of handling a tidal wave of material that was becoming almost unmanageable. I was met at the Belo Horizonte airport by Lauro Costu and his wife, and Marcia Lucia, a volunteer worker in Dr. Vorace at Embelo Rehabilitation Clinic. Whenever I needed any help in language or information, one or the other of them was always on hand. It is impossible to describe the predominating attitude of the Brazilian people and not sound as if you are overpraising them to the skies. They will do anything for a visitor, to the point where it is almost unbelievable. At first, it creates suspicion in you, until you find that their hospitality is utterly genuine and inbred. Although there must be exceptions, I never ran into any. 4. Lauro and his wife drove me to Congonhas do Campo, translated interviews endlessly for 3 days and evenings, and never showed a sign of the exhaustion I felt. We were received so warmly by Arrigo Atm's widow, Alit, and several of his grown sons that I felt like a prodigal son coming home. In addition to hospitality, they offered all Arrigo Atm's clippings, diaries, and correspondence, and hours of anecdotes they recalled regarding Arrigo Atm's life and work. Alit, her hair definitely in curlers, was a shy and diffident woman, with a quiet, infectious charm. She was preparing to move to Belo to live near one of her sons who had recently moved there, Tarcísio, who was a strapping, bronzed young man in his 20s, handsome as a movie star, arranged for photocopying of any of the material I requested. He also drove me out to Arrigo Atm's grave, high on the hill overlooking Congonhas in a small walled cemetery. It was late in the afternoon, and an ominous mountain thunder 225 storm was gathering. The scene turned into a black and grey El Greco painting as Tarcísio, who obviously worshipped his father, placed several roses on the grave and told me about the tragic accident on the R-135. On the way back to the village, he stopped and pointed out the place where the accident had happened 2 years before, as if this ritual might ease the pain that showed clearly in his face. Congonhas do Campo was as lovely as the tourist brochures said it was, although there were the poor and underprivileged that Arrigo worked so hard in the service of. Even the awe-inspiring statue of Elia Jadina could not erase that scar. At the little, open front Café Tilda Copyright near the Rue Amaréchal Floriano, I met Dr. Maura Godoy, now the mayor of the town, who claimed that neither he nor anyone else could explain how Arrigo did what he did, but that there was no question in his mind that Arrigo had literally been the eighth wonder of the world. He said that the more medical knowledge a person had, the more Arrigo was appreciated. In fact, anyone who had not performed surgery would not be able to understand fully what it meant to cut into the deep organs of the body without tying off blood vessels and without anesthesia. As the one medical doctor who had had a chance to observe Arrigo intensively over a long period of time, he was rather convincing. I wasn't TMT quite prepared for what happened the next day. The front page headlines broke all over Brazil to reveal that Arrigo Atm's youngest brother, Eli, had suddenly declared that he had been visited by the same sort of hallucinations that had plagued Arago in his early days, and that both Arago and Dr. Fritz had appeared to him in the middle of the night to urge him to carry on the work of his departed brother. By noon, the town of Congonhas was beleaguered with reporters from the press, radio, and television, and nearly all the members of the Arago family went into hiding. Eli was a successful law student at the university in Billow, and had been highly regarded in his work. I was able to corner him in the dining room of the Hotel Freitas, out of the way of the rest of the press that was looking for him. He looked 226, something like a slighter version of Arago, with bright, penetrating brown eyes, and seemed very disturbed and confused about the recent visitation, which he claimed he did not seek or want. Nearly all the rest of the family, including Arago Atiemes' brothers and his sons, were dead set against the idea. They simply would not discuss it. By the time I left Brazil, the situation was still unresolved. One benefit that came out of the incident was that it brought Manchete photojournalist Isco Murta to town, who was as widely informed as anyone about Arago, having covered the healer in depth in several stories over the last 9 or 10 years of Arago Atiemes' life. Isco, a native of Finland, was an intense, vital, intelligent reporter. Like so many others, he had found that his journalistic coverage of Arago had changed his entire outlook. After having photographed Arago in action many times, he was extravagant in his wonderment at the man. But this was true of nearly everyone who volunteered information. I was a little disturbed by this, because I was convinced no man could have such a clean record. Even the padre at the Church of Bom Jesus was mild in his protest against Arago, simply saying that the church did not believe in what he had done. Most of the medical adversaries who had been against Arago had softened. About the only thing I could dig up were rumors that Arago had taken kickbacks on the prescriptions sold. But I could not verify this, nor could anyone else. I could find no one who claimed he had suffered harm or injury from his treatments, nor anyone who even suggested that he used fakery of any sort. There had been psychics in the Philippines who claimed to do surgery similar to Arago Atiemes, but they had been easily exposed as fakes, and had refused direct observation in full daylight. On returning to Belo Horizonte, I was convinced that Judge Felipe Missy would be able to give me a cold, flat appraisal of Arago, including whatever drawbacks, beyond Arago Atiemes' barnyard crudities, which everybody admitted and laughed off, the court proceedings had revealed. I was able to arrange a dinner with the judge at the Hotel Del Rey 227, through a bright young Brazilian lawyer, Dr. Paulo Zanini, who had taken his law degree on a Fulbright fellowship at the University of Michigan and who could speak fluent English. He was also responsible for getting me Xerox copies of the Haystack Bile of court records of Arago Atiemes' trial. I was more than surprised when Judge Imisi recounted his own story, in full detail. He described his voluntary observations of Arago at work with revealing conviction, told of his conferences with doctors who supported Arago Atiemes' position, as well as those against, and of his agonizing decision. He admitted that there was simply no way to describe the impact of watching Arago operate, and that the man had to be accepted as a paranormal phenomenon that could not be defined. VROPRA-SUPERSCRIPT-A2, which translates as A Black Gold ATM, is the Williamsburg of Brazil. It was once the richest mining town in the country, and its charming 18th century architecture, so infinitely well preserved, reflects the intellectual and art center that it became. Some statuary works of Ali Jadino are here, in the Baroque churches that guard the hillsides. From these heights, the dull red tile roofs create a tapestry like that of a French village on the Rhone. Along one of the steep cobblestone streets, I found the restaurant Clubco, literally meaning a dungeon ATM or a jail ATM. But its subterranean rooms, lit by bewitching candlelight, were a feast of colonial antiques that blended into a pastiche of charm. It was Isco Murta who had told me to introduce myself to the owner, a white Russian, formerly Canadian and now a Brazilian citizen, Jerry Canagan. She had been a professor of Slavic history in Canada, had taken her master at EMS degree at the Sorbonne, had come to visit Brazil, fell in love with it, bought a farm, fostered an art center at ROPRA tilde superscript A2, and now managed her thriving bistro with the hand of a master.